So, welcome to today's lecture in programming languages. Last time we have had a deeper insight into how a typical signal dispatching programming languages resolves the targets for call expressions. So we had a look at how static function dispatching looks like as well as dynamic function dispatching. What we came up with was this idea of a two-split procedure that is used here, with one phase being like the compile time part of the whole dispatching process, where you would have a lot of type analysis going on, determining the so-called static or compile time type of the call expression, and then matching it up with available dispatching candidates, in the sense that you would try to locate the most specific candidate for dispatching to, and with that fix that in the case of the Java virtual machine in its bytecode instruction that handles the dynamic dispatching. So in order to do actual dynamic dispatching, then there's another phase necessary to that, which would be provided by the Java virtual machine, which is a runtime process, meaning this is a thing that is not done once and for all during compile time, but each time the program is run, it might show a different behavior in terms of maybe different objects arriving there, having another identity, and thus dynamic dispatching would have to dispatch to a different target. In order to do that, there would be a process within the Java virtual machine that would handle the invocation of the method, which is this invoke virtual instruction. And in order to deal with that, I'm sorry, there's no working projector here. So either you have to look in those or maybe share a screen with someone else here. So there is a process that is anchored in the implementation of the runtime engine's interpretation functions for the invoke virtual, which would take the signature that is produced in the static part of the analysis, take that as a given, and look for exactly that signature within the hierarchy that is started by the class that belongs to the current object, which is a runtime type property. And then the system starts running through the chain of super references and tries to look for exactly a match for that particular signature. And that is that. So, and since the static phase has kind of located a particular signature already, this is kind of the guarantee that at one point you will reach an actual class that has a working implementation of that. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been dispatched to this one during the static dispatching phase. So that is that. So let's have a look at like more practical situations where this makes an actual difference. So the page turn, please, the thing is now an example here that all of you should probably already have encountered that have done some programming in Java, at least. So this is a usual problem that you have, that you specify a method that is used in comparison and checks whether the peer is actually considered to be equal to your current object. You do that by overriding the equals method of a thing, and like beginners would do a thing like the code that you see here, where you specify your equals method for some natural class that takes as a parameter another natural class and then does some content-based decision-making and returns its decision. And then you push that all into a set implementation like the hash set, which first of all, of course, does hash code implementation that I haven't shown in that thing, but in the end might up to do perform some actual equality checks to decide whether it has found such a thing already or not. And turns out, if you do that, you end up with having two instances of a natural zero in your collection. And you, well, the naive question would be, why is that? Is that actually buggy? But turns out this is exactly an instance of the problem that we have seen before, where you tried to override a method, particularly the equals equals with object, specializing for a particular subclass. However, since in Java there is this specific notation where you have like the first parameter implicitly given of the type of the class that is surrounding by you, and the thing that you use here is actually your second parameter, this is not a case of an actual candidate for dispatching in that sense, because this is not a specializer in the sense as we have talked about that for objects equals object function, but instead this would be something completely different. The actual one that you would have wanted is naturals natural specialization of the equals to object version. So you would have to actually mention a real object in there. So this is, you need to keep attention to the exact signature of that. So next big slide would be a short mini quiz to get you engaged in actual kind of more complex decision making than just this easy equals to object thing. So this is of course a little bit ridiculous, since you can all page down now by yourself and see the answer already. But if you are more into like an actual real challenge, then you might not do so, but try to figure out yourself what's happening there. So it's a very easy example. It just has two classes, one extending the other, and a lot of methods and mixed names between M1, M2, and M3, and uses parameters A and B and all that, so not too much involved there. There's one method that doesn't do any tricks. This is just this P thing that will be used for output of some string in that sense. So situation one is like you have an instantiation of a B type object that is referred to from variable B of type B. You create another reference to that of type A. You can do so since it's like core essence of object orientation. You can do this assignment and have like a second reference to that, and then you perform an actual method call like the one that you see here with M1 on A with parameter B. So the question is now, what's going to appear in the output for this one? So what's it going to be?
So per committee, we decided that M1 A in A would be the correct choice because we use so we assign B to an A type. So I think that that it looks in A first to find the matching signature.
So let's uncover that. M1 of A in A is correct in that sense, and Yeah, you have to actually really do the same steps as a compiler does in order to riddle out what that means. So you start from like the expression in doubt, which is this one here. And first of all, you have to determine the actual compile time type of that thing. So what that means is you, for each of the variables that are in play here, you have to determine the static or compile time type. What that usually means is like the type with which this variable was declared. So for this, A has compile time type large A, B has compile time type large B. So these are the compile time types. Now you have to check what the most specific implementation is that matches that thing. So for that you look into class A and check what are possible candidates. So M1 has two implementations there. Only one has an actual parameter, so there is not much that you can actually do about that. It's just one implementation that's going to be chosen here. So this is signature M1 of A. That is the signature that is determined during compile time. Then we might wonder what happens at runtime in the next step. Well, what's done is for that, you have to look at the dynamic type of the receiver for that, because this is kind of the specializing part of the whole thing, and the receiver is of runtime type. Well, this you can follow by backtracking in your program where the actual new statement comes from. So A got refers to B, B refers to this constructor here, so the runtime type is B for this small A. So for that we have to then look into the actual body of these classes with the signature from the last step in mind and scan for an actual literal match of the signature that we have determined in the first step. So this was this M1 of A. And there is no such thing within the body of B, so no match. We go to its parent that we get through the extends clause in the type definition, which is over there, and there we find there's an actual match here, M1 of A, so this is what's going to be executed then, and this just outputs M1A in A. So that is like the process that is behind that, and that is just what you have to repeat now for the next few steps. So, next example. Any idea of what that's going to give? So, idea would be?
M1 being B.
Looks to be correct. So the thing, the only difference here is that we have as parameter now a B thing here, and so all the static types involved here will be B. So for that now, we get static type of large B M1B, which means that we can look into B for looking for a potential dispatching target. And is there one? Well, there's one that is has the name of M1 with a parameter large B. So this is already quite good. The question is now, usually do I continue in the search? Well, in C++, you would be definitely done at that point because you just look via default into the one, to the current scope. In Java, you would potentially go to your superclasses, but in that case, this is already the most specific type that you could locate for that. There is no chance of something that could override that. So, yeah, that is that. So, with that, you get your dispatching target, which is M1B in B. Next case is B is a new B, and you call M2 of that. I'm sorry, projector is not working today. So this is now a twofold thing, since I think M2 is pretty unique without parameters in there. So it's not a matter of what the first thing dispatches to, but like what the second call expression in there really dispatches to. So, any ideas of what that could do in there?
Yeah, I would say that it's M2 of so first and the map out M2 without any parameters from A, and this dispatches again to M2 from
M2 from
B.
From B. Looks correct in that sense. The question is, of course, which of the parameters in there's just one. So that's no question in there. So yeah. So this is an actual case of an overriding procedure in there. So you have this is clear that the first thing dispatches there, but now the question is here, where what do we dispatch to? So we have static type of, well, the receiver, which is implicitly given here since we don't have an explicit mentioning of the receiver. So this is A, the second parameter in that sense is also this, which is also A. So we have the static signature of AM2A, which will be associated with this as the compile time type thing. So now, during runtime, we have to go through the superchain, starting from the actual real runtime type in there, which is, well, in that case, a B. So we go through B's body, look for an exact match with the signature, and that's how we come to the in B part of the whole thing, since we already find M2A in there, and yeah, with that get this line in there. So that's just a last thing. Oh, it's not a last thing. Then there's this M1 thingy, which does a similar thing, but explicitly has its second parameter being of static type B. Well, I mean, any ideas on what that will give you? Sorry? M1B and B? This is like exactly one of these cases that is like a trap here in there. So here again, you have to look for a most specific type with A as a first parameter and B as the second parameter, and turns out that, well, what would have been your choice? What was your choice for this first phase?
M1B
in B. So
M1A, yeah, right. And then we do M1 of B.
So for the static part, you will find that, yeah, this is exactly the part where it goes amiss. You can't look into the other one, because statically you don't know that the receiver part is of type B, but it's type A, so you are not allowed to look in B in that sense. There's no specialization going on there. So you have to look in class A for that, and this is like the most special thing that you can find for that. So that's why we go to M1A in A. And the last one, I think, is just...
My question.
Yes?
Why did we, for the last one, for the B M2, Didn't we do exactly that? We go to...
Yes, but then there was the runtime that looked for an overridden version.
Yeah, but why are we not doing that in this case?
Because this is an exact a search for an exact literal match of the signature that you have determined in the first step, and not a more specialized version. So you still run through class B and then through class A, but you're looking for an M1 with parameter A, which you will not find in class B.
Okay.
So that is kind of the key thing to take away. And during compile time, you determine a type which might not be, in an ideal world, the one that you would choose, but it's the only thing that you can determine statically without any further knowledge about what is finding its way into your variables. And with that knowledge, you then at runtime check for a precise literal match of that signature. And that's where it breaks for a few people. Yeah. And the last thing, well, this is just messing a little bit with the super keyword, which has like statically the type of the predecessor, and yeah, with that we get a similar case as before. So it's still M1A in A. So that's that. And there's a whole lot of these quizzes that are out there, I think, in the tutorial. There's also going to be a few of them. So there's a lot more chance to get yourself confused with that. But I think it's quite healthy to, in that sense, train a little bit with these examples to get yourself into this procedure of determining the static type and then doing this. And you might wonder whether this is a thing that actually happens in practice, and let me say it actually does if you try to be clever with like very detailed class hierarchies and try to be clever about like offering specific specialized versions of methods for certain combinations that then in the end would never get called because of things not overriding each other. So this is motivated by some actual problems that we have encountered in the past. So the next section would be like a section that is about more of a extension that you maybe haven't seen so far in the standard languages, which would be multi-dispatching. So the thing that you've seen so far is single dispatching, meaning that there's a specializer on just one of the parameters, which is in languages like Java, even this implicit parameter sometimes, the receiver parameter. So this is a more general approach to the whole thing that extends that to not only the receiver parameter. So the single dispatching is the stuff that you get from usually in C++, Java, C Sharp, and all that, all of those. So is there any approaches to solving this equals problem? Well, of course, there's usually the one that you all know of, which is the solution that you see here, where you directly override the dispatching base thing from the base class. This equals of object, and well, that turns out to work. However, this is a thing that means that you as a programmer have to kind of make sure that you will interpret all the types right, that you will land in this thing and potentially land in there, and also this also means that you need some means of introspecting what your class offers, what your class's identity is, like this instance of keyword that will let you inspect the runtime type of a particular object. So if that is the case, then this is like a meaningful solution to the whole thing. You might wonder whether you could, whether it's a silly thing to have like an equalizable interface in the generic way with just objects. But if it's supposed to be generic, why not use things like type parameters for that? And you can do so. This will lead you to an approach with generic programming, where you then do things like a new equalizable interface that has a type parameter, which you can instantiate with whatever type you want to compare your thing to. So, for example, natural, you could let implement equalizable of natural, and then you would have to provide the method with natural as a parameter. For that to work, of course, you would have to have an API library a class library that supports your new equalizable interface as well. Otherwise, it doesn't know about this specialization thing and will just call the bog old equals to object. And if that works, then you might end up with an actual working code, except that in the case of Java, for example, you will get the behavior that this natural will be compiled down to standard generics-free code, which will mean that this will translate into an actual equals of object method that is there for providing the functionality in there. So it's the carrier for this functionality, but this is already this is kind of a name clash there, since this equals of object is already defined for the whole thing. So this is a thing that the compiler usually doesn't allow you to do, and particularly if you have a whole hierarchy of of objects that all are supposed to be equalizable to objects of their same hierarchy depth, well, you will get these collisions a lot of times. So this is maybe not a thing that really scales for your hierarchies of objects in that sense. The last idea that's out there is pattern that is in use, that is promising to provide double dispatching. What that means is that there is a facility like this equals dispatcher class that is there to exploit dynamic dispatching for the first parameter in order to perform some of the dispatching there. So you have this equals dispatcher offering two implementations, dispatch for natural and dispatch for object, which are supposed to carry the relevant code for comparing to the particular versions of the thing there, and it is applied in a particular way, meaning that in the equals thing, you would, instead of doing some instance of, you would return the result of the double dispatch thing on the object with overloading the overriding the dispatch method of your choice and performing the actual comparison in there. And if you do so, you bind to the double dispatch. In this sense, you will override with an actual call to the dispatcher, where you will make the second parameter explicitly bind to your current type, which is the natural thing here. And this means that you somehow revert the roles of the dispatching from the first parameter to the second, and you will then make the actual typing explicit by matching your current type with a parameter type, which is then the static type of the whole thing. So you select that way the correct handler that you want to do. So, yeah, that is one way of doing that will actually work. But for that to work, you would need some kind of dispatcher that would know like all the possible dispatching targets in there. And this might work for like closed environments where you have just a few pairs that you want to compare to each other, a few possibilities of how the parameter can turn out with its type, but that's not a general solution in that sense. But still, that's a solution that is out there. So instead, what can be done is what's called multi-dispatching, which is a feature that will extend on the specializing of just the first parameter, the receiver parameter, to all the parameters of a function. So you introduce specializers for all of them and have dispatching based on the actual runtime identity of all your parameters. So, yeah, for that you need some kind of dispatching mechanisms that selects most specific concrete methods instead of matching with literal static signature. Instead, you look for most specific signature. So in the example that you were asking, this would be what the multiple dispatching approach would have done. It would have looked for a more specific or most specific version that matches that thing, still keeping to the general static type of the call expression. And yeah, you can implement that even like as an extension to like single dispatching languages with means like a preprocessor where you do this dispatching kind of manually if you have things like this introspection into types. And this is what has been done, for example, for the Java language in some experimental add-on called multi-Java in that sense. Yeah. What was there to say for that? I have to look a little bit. Yeah. What you buy yourself into with something like that is that the typical compile time errors that you had before, remember these things where you could get compile errors when you have two competing overloaded versions of static methods that would specialize first parameter and second parameter each in turn. And then you would get a call expression that would specialize both parameters. You would have an ambiguous expression in that sense. This is a thing that with multiple dispatching can now happen even at runtime. So at runtime you might have dynamic types that specialize, that match both specializer 1 and specializer 2, so you might get a runtime exception that says, well, don't know what to do at that particular position. So that is one of the drawbacks that you buy yourself into. Yeah. Apart from that, for dispatching to these actual multi-dispatch functions, you will have to run through an actual matching process in that sense that will check for all the possible subtypes that are matchable somehow, and this, depending on how many parameters, how many possible subtypes there are, this might be quite the chain of comparisons that you have to go through. However, this is still a thing that will only happen when an actual real multi-dispatch is triggered in your language, so there's no actual overhead for standard method calls in that sense, because they can just be dispatched as regular. So this is the thing. And, well, how does that look in practice? There's this... Well, a proposed has been a proposed syntax for that, with multi-Java, where you would feature the in the parameters that would have to be multi-dispatched. Two types now, one being the base type, which had been the former static base type used for dispatching, and then the actual specializer being added with the at symbol, which means that this is a thing that triggers whenever the static type of a call expression would yield object as a parameters type. And when the runtime type is a natural, then this is the method that is meant to be targeted. So this is a thing that would work in that sense. In terms of what happens behind the scenes is that, well, all you get is that there is an actual dispatching code generated in the JVM syntax in that sense, and all that it does is it will actually really check the whatever instance of gives you, and if that equals a particular class, then we will call the specialized version, which is having parameter of natural, or the non-specialized version, which has the plain old object as its parameter type. So this is no magic that is happening there. Yeah, so there's this, and this is what is done in the plain old object code in that sense. So is that a thing that has made it somehow into actual real languages? Because that was like just a research prototype for the Java world. And, well, there is some. For example, there's Perl 6 here. And, yeah, this is an example where you can see that running. So there's, for multiple dispatching, you have this keyword multi. And, yeah, you have the dispatch base code here with the base type that it's called cool here, and then we have two specialized versions for int and string and int here, and then we can instantiate those things with runtime types one and string, and then wonder what happens there. And well, first parameters of runtime type int, the second one of runtime type string, so this will dispatch to version one. If we then continue giving the first parameter also a string, what will happen there? Well, Perl 6 doesn't opt for an actual runtime exception here, but instead will just dispatch to the base implementation of the whole thing. But yeah, that's what you'll get for that. There's even more languages, like for example Clojure, which is a Lisp dialect for the JVM that also offers an implementation here.
I don't understand why there would be an exception here.
Yeah, there is no real version where both are strings in there.
Right, so there's no ambiguity, right? That's the only thing that can be called the base one.
Yeah, well, this in that case, the base one also has an implementation. So you could also have ones where there is no implementation for that. But in this respect, I don't have any ones with. Oh, yeah, I didn't put ones with just cool as the alternative here. Yeah. Maybe I would, that was not a good example here for an actual ambiguity.
So if we had a third function, for example, that had arguments of type cool and string, saying dispatch 3, would that one be called, or would the base one be called? Then the base one would still be called because of the ambiguity and the resolution to the base class. Or
I think it just doesn't have an runtime exception here, but I would have to check. I mean, there's a lot of languages in there. I don't know how they all deal with these cases, but yeah. It's maybe not a good example here for, since I have int and string as parameters and not this cool thing here. So yeah. Anyway, the other one I wanted to show is like this Lisp dialect here that, well, Lisp is a little bit peculiar because it has like a very different syntax to what you're used to. So, yeah, it's based on just lists usually, and these lists are always delimited with brackets, and everything in there is expressed as a list of, well, whatever thing you put in there. You can create functions in list form by putting as the first symbol in the list this fn symbol there. Usually the first thing that is found in a list determines how the list is interpreted usually. So in Lisp you usually look at the first position in your list and then decide how you interpret that. You can derive relationships between items here with this derive thingy, and then there's this def multi and def method, which is like what I wanted to specifically focus here in the following examples. So these are like the things to go for, this def multi and def method, where the def multi would declare like the base signature for in terms of types of how to on what to actually do dispatching, and def method would be like the definition of possible targets where to dispatch to. So how does that look in examples? So here I have introduced a few small relations between certain items, so that you can have like these otherwise not associated with any value fragments in here, this child and parent thing that in our world now are related to each other in this relation. And then we have the actual declaration of multi-dispatched method in this part here. So we define first with def multi that there's going to be a name fun for methods that are going to be multiple dispatched, and this will have a dispatching function attached that works on two parameters and gives like a result also consisting of two values that decide whether you dispatch to that version or not. And yeah, so that is that. You specify a name for multi-dispatching and a dispatching function. This dispatching function is pretty basic. It just gives back whatever it gets as parameters. So in the second and third line, you have two dispatching candidates that dispatch on this function named fun, depending on whatever the dispatching function has returned. So the sequence that you see here, child would be expected to be the result of the dispatching function applied to the current parameters. So in case and our dispatching function is particularly simple, it just pipes through whatever is it's given. So if the parameters had been child and child, then the expression from over here is then given back as the result of the complete function, which is equals on child in that sense. Here, if you specialize, this is specialization for whenever the dispatching function would return parent, then we would dispatch to parent equals. And you call that, like in this context of a print, you call fun with the two parameters child and child. This will go through the dispatching function, which will directly return the sequence child child as the thing on which to dispatch to the candidates. And on child child, we will have, like, this will match the first thing, and then this will mean that child equals will be what is given back. So far, there's not much magic done. We just piped the actual values through. But you can do pretty funky stuff with that by defining, like, more elaborate dispatching functions. So this is a more creative example. We have centrally also a definition of a multi-dispatched function, which we call print, and the dispatching function for this one dispatches based on one parameter, which is then supposed to be the one parameter for the method itself, and it dispatches based on whatever this function salary applied to the wage attribute of the person will do. So here in the dispatching function, we call person's weight attribute and give it to the salary function. The salary function is given up there, which is like some switch, or in that case, I think it's just a chain of... You just check the salary for the actual amount, and if the amount is smaller than 600, you're labeled poor. If the amount is larger or equal than 5,000, you're labeled rich. And in every other case, you're labeled average. So that is what the salary will give back: poor, rich, or average. And then later on, you see the dispatch candidates here. Poor, average, and rich is like the tags that we have given here for a reason for dispatching. This is this print method works on one parameter, which is this person thing, and then for the poor person, we assume that this is some kind of student assistant. So we give back the string Hebe and person's name. Average, well, this is like a postdoc, so this is doctor and the name of the person, and rich is then the professor, like that. So you can imagine that with that kind of customization, you can do a lot of creative dispatching in your code. Oh, I forgot to print out whatever happens there for the example down there. But yeah, you have the full control on the dispatching with that.
So you achieve some kind of pattern matching with this.
That is what I came up with there. But you can do all sorts of...
These, like you said, attributes, poor, rich, average, are some kind of like runtime types created by you.
Yes. Right? Yeah. So this is created by me.
So if you go just a little bit back in the previous example, yes, assume that now you would call, I don't know, the function with the combination child parent.
Oh yeah, I
get the runtime.
I had this derive thingy here that would set up that a parent is also a child is also a parent. So this would then still match to the parent one, I guess.
Okay. So each child is a parent as well in the hierarchy.
Yeah, but this hierarchy or object-oriented understanding of types doesn't really translate that well into this Lisp world anyway. So in general, that's just to show you that there is systems out there that let you do your own dispatching based on whatever concept you would like to have. So you can, in that sense, introduce your own idea of how method dispatching and object orientation and all that would work in such a system like Clojure, in that sense. So yeah, that's that. So, yeah, this is what multi-dispatching then looks like in practice and in theory. So you can consider that as like an extension of what single dispatching has already started for you. So it's an established technique, just taken a few steps further. And well, there is actual practical applications for things like that, with like multiple dispatch as a need arises sometimes. And usually you would have to do a lot of boilerplate code in just single dispatching systems, where you have to manually fork to these things, and manually doing repetitive stuff is usually a thing where you would like to the code to be generated automatically for you, and that's what the multiple dispatching languages do for you in that sense. And yeah, what is maybe a little bit of a letdown there is that, well, a lot of the so-called standard languages put a lot of stress on the actual first parameter being the privileged parameter, being this one receiver of a method call. And with multiple dispatching, you introduce like similar behavior as this implicit first parameter has for all the other parameters. So in that sense, it breaks a little bit with this semantics of the languages like C++ or C sharp or Java and all those. And you would probably want to go back to a language that or a way of specifying that that would undo like this specialization of the receiver in order to get rid of this break in concepts in that sense. Yeah, a little bit of runtime overhead is there, of course, because you have to do this search for most specific somehow, or well, code that with this instance of things in your code already. So it's a little, you pay a little bit for that, and depending on how you define the semantics of your language, you might also get even more exceptions when doing this, particularly when there's multiple inheritance involved in that. Yeah. Okay. So that is like what I prepared for the multi-dispatching. And since we still have a little bit of time left, and someone botched up the evaluation of lectures, there's still like a little time to look at the next thing, I would say. So, did you get the email yet? Oh, well, we're supposed to do so this week, so this is why the lecture ends a little bit early. So we can still continue with the next one. Oh, you don't have the slides for this one, do you?
Wait, we could use the old ones?
Maybe? Yeah, at least, yeah, there should not be too much difference. At least in this particular one. Are they accessible somewhere?
Oh, they are on the website.
Oh, yeah, there's the old ones from the, yeah. But there's probably not single slide mode, is there?
No, there are six slides.
Semester.
Oh, last winter semester.
Last winter semester.
So it's not the shiny new 16:9 format then, but still should do. Okay, but well, we can use the time that we have here to maybe start off a little bit with the like more common things in there, so that you get used a little bit to what we are doing in there, and then next time we're gonna dive deeper into what I want to do here. So, the next section is on multiple inheritance, as in like. How is that implemented in current systems, particularly in C++? So, yeah. First of all, we talk a little bit about the inheritance principles in there and have a look at how implementation inheritance compares to interface inheritance and what there is as choices for implementing function dispatching in that area, because, well, what we've seen so far is like the Java Virtual Machine approach in its naive version, like everything being interpreted, and there is more specialized versions out there that are actually state of the art. Particularly, we want to in this lecture look at the way that the Clang LVM project does its implementation of the function dispatching in presence of multiple inheritance, in terms of how the memory layout is working for these systems, and how the actual runtime generated code for multiple dispatching looks like. We will start off with just basics of inheritance, look at single inheritance and virtual method dispatching in this particular object design with these optimizations that are introduced in C++, and then go on with multiple parents of classes. That is what's new with multi-inheritance, and how that works together with virtual methods and, for example, situations like common parents. So in between, we will have an excursion on linearization of type hierarchies, which is a concept that is out there for some languages that are not C++, which means that instead of having like an inheritance tree, we will have to come up with some kind of linearization of all the parents, so that we can restrict ourselves to, or well, that we can make use of the concepts that there are for single inheritance. And yeah, for that, we will have a look at linearization algorithms. So the general motto for what we want to go for here is removing this this paradigm of everything just has one parent, and go over to code that has class hierarchies with several parents instead. For that, we look at the very basics of what we can do first before we then step by step extend the basic approaches to then come up with the final thing. So first of all, what is the two notions of inheritance that I could find out there? Well, there's two notions in which inheritance is usually approached. There's the what I call implementation or interface inheritance. So what implementation inheritance is, well, I don't know how it is for exactly you, but the introduction to Java that I knew was kind of centered around this idea of implementation inheritance as a motivation for object orientation inheritance at all, where you would say that with implementation inheritance, you get some kind of code reusage by, well, having your parent essentially provide methods that you can use within your child's implementation, and the child only specializes what the parent has begun in that sense. And there's room for replacing implementations that your parent has provided with custom ones. This concept of overriding. So this is in that sense, the parent somehow acts as a library of common behaviors, whereas code sharing with interface inheritance somehow a little bit the other way around. In that sense, you would usually have some kind of algorithm implemented somewhere which would be capable of being run on your particular object of interest right now, as long as it somehow complies to a particular behavioral contract that is specified in terms of an interface, in the sense that you have to provide particular signatures for methods that are then used within that within that particular algorithm. So, in that sense, when you do interface inheritance, the child then would provide methods that apply to signatures that are predetermined by the parent interface in that sense. So, this is like having some kind of generic code frame that lets you plug in your implementation of that behavioral contract and work with that. So this is what is made explicit in Java or C# with this concept of interfaces. Oh, yeah, me and UML, I'm not particularly fond of like these UML diagrams. Let's maybe skip a little bit about them. So, yeah, what you can take away of is that for implementation inheritance, you can maybe have like two classes from which you inherit now instead of just one. In that sense, and from them just get particular functionality, whereas in interface inheritance you would like just have two different behavioral contracts that you would support in one implementation in that sense. So this is like that. So apart from like this more conceptual ideas behind that, what are the practical implications of having these systems implemented? So for that, I would be largely interested in how I would have to organize my heap or stack in presence of objects and certain structures like interfaces or plain object inheritance with one parent, several parents, and for that I would have to look into how the something closer to the machine represents the code instead of like the high level code, and therefore, well, there is a thing that is very close to machine code, but still a little bit more abstract, that is easily approachable, which is the intermediate representation of the LLVM. Well, LLVM is a compiler framework that is has gained some reputation in the past like 10 years for being easily accessible and very modular, in the sense that there's a lot of front ends in terms of languages that all compile to a common middle piece, that is this LLVM IR, that then gets heavily optimized, and then there's a lot of output modules that you can plug in there for different target architectures. So this is what the LLVM IR looks like with respect to what we're going to see in this part of the lecture. So the IR in there is kind of assembly-like language that still has a certain basic understanding of type structures. So you can define things like composite types in this very machine, close to machine framework, the way that you see in these first two lines. So these are two types for that are named A and B here, that are composed from several subtypes. You can have like basic integer types with integer of 32 bits or integer of 64 bits in there, or just 8-bit width. So this is like basic types. You can compose several of these types together with like just a comma, separated from each other, and you can also refer from one struct to another. So one struct can be a subcomponent of another one by just mentioning its name. So struct B is like the second component of struct A, and you can have like more the usual composite types, like here for example this is a pointer to a function returning integer 32 with a parameter of integer 32. So that's that. You can also express things like arrays with these square brackets here. So this is 20 times an integer of 32, and this is 10 times in a row in that. So this is a two-dimensional array in that sense. And this, all of that is the second component of struct B. So what you get in this context is that you do your addressing of data structures not integers representing addresses anymore, but more abstractly, like integers being offsets into the nth component of your current structure level. And if you want to do sub-addressing in there, you would have like nested index structures. So in order to navigate in these structures, then you somehow need to find your way around those. There is, for assembly languages, a quite high-level facility for that, which is this get element pointer instruction that you can run with an arbitrary struct of a particular type. For example, this percent A, these percent things are usually some kind of variables there. So this percent A is of type pointer to struct, and with that you would then be able to do nested indexing on this thing by this list of indices that are in there, and you have to read them in the way that like this first index, this zero here, is applied to the outermost type of that thing, which is in that case the pointer. So this index of zero navigates into the pointer to an A. And the second parameter here is this 2. This would be mean this is the zero-based slot number 2, so the third component within such an struct A type thing. So this would point to 0, 1, 2, to this component. Okay? And this can be this is then this percent one will be the handle to that component, which is still not the actual real value, but still has to be loaded from memory. This reflects this idea of having a kind of abstract navigation expression as one piece of the whole story, and then a load that would then be able to obtain from this handle where this thing is actually really in memory. So this has to be loaded from percent one, and this is what the type of that will be. This is pointed to a function, so this goes into percent two, which then can be used for actual calling. And this is what the call expression down there does. So it calls with return type I32, with parameter I32, based on this percent 2 that we obtained from within that structure somehow, and the parameter is 42, like always. So that is kind of how you have to interpret what you find there. So this is a little bit more than these plain assembly languages that you might know from introduction to hardware lectures. So, that is. There's a little bit more to what we will see in LVM, but the other things are usually well easily understood if you know a little bit of assembly and programming and all that. But this is like a little bit more special, so that's why I show it to you here. Yeah. What else is there to say? Oh, yeah, well, this LVM, if you are interested into what certain constructs are translated to, what you can usually do is you can just try it out yourself, and particularly the examples that we do in the lecture, you can simply give to the Clang compiler yourself and obtain like similar graphics or explanations than the ones that we see in the next few slides with a few simple instructions. So you can, for example, get a representation of the memory layout of a compilation unit, which will usually be of interest as soon as we start talking about classes, with this instruction over here. So this dump record layouts will kind of give you some ASCII art representation of how composed objects are layouted in that sense. So you will get the graphics in kind of ASCII art form also from that thing. And the actual real action code that is used, like for all the member functions, methods, thingies, you will get from this second call. You might have to look a little bit into the details there. Usually there's also a little bit of name mangling going on, but you can demangle that with certain other calls, and then you can decipher what methods actually are called in there. So this is what the second line is all about. So these are kind of the tools that we can use for all that. So let's maybe start right into what we're doing there. So basic object layout for classes. For that, I have started with a very easy example. It's just three classes that inherit from each other. That's class A, class B inheriting from class A, class C inheriting from class B. So this is a linear inheritance structure in that sense. There's no multiple parents involved. Each class has one single parent. Each class brings a particular method to the table. I have omitted like the public column parts from here due to space reasons, but usually you would consider for these examples here that all the methods and attributes, I don't care about the authorization stuff in there, public, private, that's not what we're talking about here. So usually everything is considered to be public. I just put them away from the slides, not in order for not to clutter everything. So in terms of memory layout, what that means is that you will get a certain structure generated by the Clang compiler, which is in this section directly under the picture. So you'll see that class A is represented as a composed type of just one component, which is an integer 32, which happens to coincide with like this int A thingy over there. So this is just one integer that is needed in there. Class B is considered to be inheriting from class A, thus it has to, in principle, do all the things that class A does, and this is reflected in the type declaration of its representation as the type for class B, referring to the struct that represents class A internally. So the first component of that representation is class A, and you add the integer 32 to the end of that thing. And same you do for class C. Class C extends class B or inherits from class B. Thus, it refers to what class B is and extends it with I32. And so with that you get extensions of the original class always at the end of the representation, which corresponds to like your class representation being organized in a way that you see here, where a representation for the C class is represented starting with A, then B, then C in the order that the it was extending its base object. Like first there's the components for A, the components for B, and then the components for C. This is quite handy for to do so due to certain concepts like reusage of code, which we're going to see how that works. So in terms of a method call like this call to G with 42 as parameter, how is that translated? Well, first of all, there's the class C generated. This is allocated just like this here with alloc A and gets referred to by this percent %C. Then what happens for that thing is that the implicit first parameter to this G is supposed to be a B object. So you will see here a bit cast here, which essentially does nothing in particular for the representation that we have seen here, since, well, this C class, since it is constructed the way it is and layouted so that the its B identity kind of overlaps with its C identity, you don't have to cast around any addresses or anything. Instead, this is just the same starting address as the C thing. So this will not really do anything in particular. But still, in terms of typing, since this is a typed assembly thing, it still needs this bit cast instruction. So this percent %1 now has type of pointing to class B, goes as into the first implicit receiver parameter of G, and together with a parameter of 42 constitutes to a call expression in there. And this is how like basic object layout works. Why is this such a this layout such a nice thing? Well, for example, if you would consider the implementation of G accessing its attribute B, the thing is that for this implementation, you would like to reuse that code, not only for calls to G when they are called on a B object, but also when it's called on a C object or whatever object later on is used. You still would like to reuse the code that you have created once for, well, otherwise you will get a whole a binary full of all the possible combinations that you could call that from. So in order to do so, what is done is that you try to the body here needs to access its B attribute that was specified within B. For that to work, you actually need something that that works together with this get element expression with an index of 0 and 1. And this is usually done by having a B object as parameter in there. So, yeah.
What does that 1 stand for again? 532.1. What does that 1 stand for again?
0 is to navigate into the pointer. This one is the zero-based index of a slot in the struct. So if you go into the B struct definition, you see the second parameter is the I32, which is like the attribute slot. So the one here is zero index, the second second slot in there. So this will guide you to the implementation of B. For that to work, you absolutely need a B to be there. So for a static method call like this one, you usually want to emanate from a B pointer class type of thing. So yeah, this is what is provided as an implementation for this function. Thus, this is what gets called, and in order for that to work out, even in situations where you have child classes there, what you do is you first of all cast your actual type into the type of the static function, and then do the actual call as if you would have an object of the type that it was specified with. Yes?
And then the representation of the classes. Did you want it to the function on purpose? So for example, here for class A equals type I32. Did you omit the F?
The F?
Yes, so A has an F function, but it's not represented in the LLVM.
Yes, this is on purpose, and this is to do with the function not being specific for an actual object representation. So an instance of an object is usually sharing the pointer to a function with all the other instances of objects of the same type. So the function doesn't contribute to the identity of the object and isn't thus found in the representation of the object. Instead, what you have is, well, the compiler can directly read off from its static typing what address it should use for that. So for static dispatching, and this is all statically dispatched, there's no virtual keyword there, so that's a thing that I have forgot to mention for the people who are more used to Java or C# or whatever. Well, C# also has its specifier for virtual, doesn't it? Well, I'm a little bit confused with all these languages right now, but yeah, in C++ you have to explicitly specify whenever a function is actually dynamically dispatched. So these are not dynamically dispatched, they are statically, so you just read off from your actual call expression. If you analyze that as being as matching this particular signature, you can read off from here that this is not virtual dispatch. So you can directly find the address to which you have to dispatch to. So there's no need for anything specific for that particular object. So there's no function represented in this struct. Yeah. Okay. And I think this is like the basic layout that will get you started into the details of virtual dispatching next time. So, I want to stop here for today and thank you for your attention, and let's continue next time.